TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The New Pearl Harbor. You are about to hear part two of a two-part interview with the Professor of Philosophy of Religion, David Ray Griffin. The historian Howard Zinn said, "David Ray Griffin has done admirable and painstaking research in reviewing the mysteries surrounding the 9/11 attacks. It is the most persuasive argument I have seen for further investigation of the Bush administration's relationship to that historic and troubling event." End of quote. Howard Zinn refers to 40 incidents reported by David Ray Griffin from existing research and literature on 9/11 that raise serious doubts about the official version about 9/11. In part one, Professor Griffin spoke about the failure of the U.S. air defenses to intercept any of the hijacked planes as they flew towards their targets. In this part of the interview, Griffin comments on the amazing fact that prior to 9/11, no steel-framed high-rise building ever collapsed due to fire. And yet, on 9/11, three buildings collapsed: the Twin Towers and Building Number 7, a block away. We started by talking about Building Number 7.
There have been some enormous fires that have completely gutted such buildings. No building has ever collapsed. And yet, on that day, it did three times, according to the official story. But focusing only on Building Number 7, even if one wants to say, well, maybe a really enormous fire could bring down a steel frame building, let's say we even granted that for the sake of argument, there was no enormous fire in Building Number 7. And yet, at 5:20 in the afternoon, it collapsed all of a sudden, and collapsed within less than 15 seconds. Furthermore, it collapsed in what is called classic style, according to controlled demolition. Controlled demolition is when you place explosives throughout the building at all the vital spots to bring the building straight down so it does not fall on neighboring buildings. And these have to be placed not only precisely, but they have to be set off in the proper order. So normally a computer would be used to set them off. And everyone who has looked at the collapse, and you can see these on many websites, I mentioned a few of them in my book, you see that this is a classic instance, or at least it mimics classic instances of controlled demolition. Furthermore, the company that was brought in to clean up the mess was actually called Controlled Demolition Incorporated. Another interesting fact, this company has advertised that it will break the steel beams and columns into pieces the appropriate size for your lifting equipment. And indeed, most of the beams, both from the Twin Towers and from Building Number 7, were broken into the size that they were just ready to load onto trucks. And here these buildings had these enormous columns in their central cores. If they could have collapsed, you would have had these enormous pieces of steel on your hands that all would have had to been cut, but evidently only very few of them had to be cut.
I guess both the emotional attachment as well as the desperate desire of people to want to not be lied to presents a real hurdle at looking a little bit more closely at the collapse of these two buildings, because quite a few things that you just mentioned about Building Number 7 are true too for the Twin Towers.
they shouldn't have collapsed either.
That's right. It's important to realize that even people who accept the official theory, if they know anything about these buildings and about engineering, say that the impact of the planes was really insignificant because these buildings were tremendously redundant. They had 47 columns up the core, and then they had over 230 columns around the outside, all steel. And so the plane knocked out a few of those peripheral columns, but the weight would have been shifted to the rest. And so one must dismiss the impact of the airplanes. Furthermore, the buildings were completely stable within 30 seconds after impact. That means then that all the destruction had to be caused by the fires. One problem with this, and again, the press has not done its job, so I don't know, I have not met one person out of 100 who knows this. The wrong tower collapsed first. That is, we all know the North Tower was hit first, and the South Tower was hit about 17, 18 minutes later. And yet, the South Tower collapsed first. Now, I want to pause to give time for that to sink in, because any fire that, if we're going to say that maybe it didn't melt the steel because it didn't, the fire from jet fuel would not come close to the temperature required to melt steel, but many people say, well, it could have significantly weakened the steel. But if that had been the case, it takes a long time when you're talking about steel. You not only need an enormous fire, but it has to burn for a long time to heat up all the steel. And yet, the fire in the South Tower had only been going 56 minutes when the South Tower collapsed, whereas the fire in the North Tower went for an hour and 42 minutes, almost twice as long. So if you've got a fire theory, you've got a big problem because the North Tower should have collapsed first. Now, people might say, oh, but we've seen the fireball from the South Tower. When the plane hit, there was a tremendous explosion, tremendous fireball. So that plane must have had a lot more jet fuel in it. Well, what happened there was that plane didn't hit center on. It hit near the edge. And therefore, much of the fuel went outside the building rather than inside, and that's what created that enormous fireball. But that didn't last very long. What happened, therefore, was that a goodly percent of the fuel in that plane burnt up within 5 to 10 minutes. And so the fires in the South Tower were actually much smaller than the fires in the North Tower, and yet the South Tower collapsed first within 56 minutes. That is one of the many features of the collapse of the towers that needs to be considered when anyone is trying to give a theory as to how they collapsed. But then there are all these other factors beyond the fact that no steel-framed high-rise building had ever collapsed by fire alone. There are at least 9 characteristics that fit controlled demolition. That is, both of the towers went down at almost free fall speed. That means that they collapsed almost as fast as if you had just dropped a brick from the top of one of the towers. That means that the upper floors were encountering virtually no resistance when they hit the lower floors. That could only be if the lower floors gave way because of controlled demolition. Furthermore, there was a total collapse. As I said, you had these enormous steel beams sticking way up into the air. And at the base, these beams were very wide and broad. So even if one accepts the official pancake theory, which is that somehow the collapse of the upper floors caused the floors below them to collapse, just like records on an old radio player with the spindle up the middle, you still would have had the spindle up the middle. That is, those 47 giant steel columns. And yet, anyone who's seen the photographs know you had a total collapse with nothing more than, say, three stories high. You should have had these steel columns sticking hundreds of feet up into the air. Furthermore, most of the concrete in the buildings was turned to dust. Now, if you would have dropped a concrete block from the top of the building, it would not turn to dust. It would break into small pieces. But to pulverize concrete into dust takes a tremendous amount of energy, the kind of energy that would come from explosives. Furthermore, and this dust was enormous. People on the ground said that it was like walking in a foot or two of snow. Furthermore, this dust didn't just fall down. It ejected out from the building maybe more than 200 feet in every direction. That is, it was forced out horizontally. What could produce that kind of ejection, that kind of momentum, other than a tremendous amount of energy coming from the buildings themselves? Furthermore, people in the building said they heard explosions, or they felt explosions, or they saw the effects that seemed to be the effects of explosions. For example, there was a 100,000-pound steel press that a guy said was just curled up like flimsy steel. Furthermore, there is seismic evidence that there were significant explosions from the sub-basements. Furthermore, there was all this molten steel. We ask, you know, people ask, why did it remain so hot under the rubble for such a long period of time? That would be consistent with molten steel having been created by very strong explosives. And then finally, a sign of a possible cover-up was the very quick removal of the steel. These steel beams are part of forensic evidence. They can be, one can examine them and see, was twinning produced, that is, a chemical reaction that is produced when steel is put up against explosives. And yet the steel was quickly removed and put on ships and shipped off to Asia, where it could not be studied. Now, how could they defend this? This is normally a federal crime to remove any material evidence from a crime scene. Well, they said, the city of New York said, we need to see if there are any victims under here, and that is more important now in case anybody might still be alive. But back to building number 7. It was evacuated, according to the official account, at about noon, and it was not until 5:20 that it collapsed. And so there was no reason to believe there would be any victims whatsoever under Building 7, and yet the steel was removed from it just as quickly.
Is there an official report by FEMA about the Twin Towers as well as for Building 7?
If you read the report from the FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, you see that they have no explanation. And particularly with regard to building number 7, they're clearly embarrassed because they give a theory as to how beams, something might have fallen from the Twin Towers and gone through several walls and then got in touch with the diesel fuel and maybe some pumps malfunctioned and pumped the diesel fuel up to the fire, the floor where the fire was and so on. And after giving all that possible explanation, they say, but this has a very low level of probability. So FEMA itself admitted that, and here's sotto voce, they admitted, leaving out the possibility of controlled demolition, that there is no explanation whatsoever of why building number 7 collapsed. And then you add to the top of this rather remarkable statement by Larry Silverstein, who had recently leased these buildings and had taken out an enormous insurance policy on them, from which he hopes to gain about $1 billion. He said on a PBS show, and this is beyond belief that he would have said this in public, but he did. He said, well, at a certain time, the fire chief called me and told me, we don't think we're going to be able to save building number 7, so we better evacuate it. And Larry Silverstein says, well, you know, we've had such loss of life, maybe the best thing to do is just go ahead and pull it. Well, pull is the slang term for controlled demolition, for bringing a building down with controlled demolition. And Silverstein went on to say, and so we made the decision to pull, and we sat there and watched the building collapse. So here you have an incredible statement. The owner of the building saying that they deliberately brought them down. Of course, that was done after FEMA had done its embarrassing report. And yet, this has received no press in this country. This is incredible that here you have what many would call the crime of the century. You have this enormous mystery of how Building 47 could have been brought down by fire, particularly tiny little fires. And then you have the owner of the building saying, we brought it down deliberately, and yet nobody pays attention. There's no follow-up here. And, of course, what that suggests is if building number 7 came down, and then you look at the videos and you see that with some differences, because buildings, the Twin Towers collapsed from the top instead of from the bottom like building number 7 did. But apart from that and a couple other differences, you have the same pattern there with these buildings falling essentially straight down into their own footprint and, again, very quickly, almost free-fall speed. The fact that Silverstein seemingly publicly admitted that building number 7 was brought down by controlled demolition, wouldn't that mean that the two towers were brought down? But, of course, this is unspeakable because this would mean that those people were deliberately sacrificed for the sake of, and then you can fill that in as to what you think the motive might have been.
Why do you think there's still so much resistance to the views you express in your book?
Well, here we have to distinguish between resistance in the press and, of course, in the government, and resistance among the public. I don't find much resistance among the public. All I find is ignorance because the press has not informed them. But I find that when people read my book, virtually everyone that I have heard about has been convinced or at least greatly disturbed by it, saying, I fear it may be true, but I don't want to believe it, and so I won't. But nevertheless, most of the reaction to the book has been positive. For example, if you go on Amazon.com and read the customer reviews, right now there is about 78 of them. And 70 of them, I believe, have 5 stars. And so the public seems to be willing, particularly, I think, more recently, as people have realized the Bush administration has lied about Iraq. Some people know it also lied about Afghanistan as to the real reasons for going to war. And I explained those in my book, that this war was on the books long before 9/11 happened. And given this record of lying, that more people are willing now to say, well, you know, maybe the Bush administration has lied about the initiating event, that is 9/11 itself.
You talk in your book about, you phrase it kindly as contradictory statements on 9/11 by the Bush administration. Which ones of these contradictory statements do you find most worrisome?
Well, it would be hard, I guess, to put those in order of priority. One that people know the most about is this statement that they had no inkling prior to 9/11 that airplanes might be used as terrorist instruments. That one was sufficiently debunked by the 9/11 Commission. So the 9/11 Commission did perform some service, and this was one thing, bringing out that there was far more advanced knowledge than the administration had wanted to admit. More serious than that was the claim that there was no specific knowledge. The administration is still saying this, even though they finally had to make public the August 6th memo, which talks about bin Laden's group plans to use airplanes to attack within the United States. One might wonder how much more specific one can get than that. But yet, there were warnings that were even more specific. As I mentioned in the book, there are some FBI agents who went to David Shippers, who was the attorney who prosecuted Clinton, and therefore should have had good credibility in Republican circles. Shippers says that he tried to tell Attorney General Ashcroft that he had specific information about upcoming terrorist attacks. He says that these guys said Lower Manhattan and even had the dates right, and yet Ashcroft would not return his calls. He didn't want to know. Another bit of specific information, probably the most specific, is the fact that all these put options were purchased on United Airlines, American Airlines, and Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which had 22 floors in the World Trade Center. Now, a put option is when you something you purchase on the stock market that is betting that the stock is going to go down. And, of course, the stock did go dramatically down after 9/11 because those were the airlines whose planes were used in the attacks. And we have pretty good information that the CIA and probably other intelligence agencies monitor the stock market looking precisely for such warning signals. So here they would have had the warning that United American Airlines were going to be used in terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. You can't get much more specific than that. And these put options were purchased just the 2 or 3 days prior to 9/11. And so they would have also known pretty closely about what day to expect it. So that is one set of lies that the American people should find very disturbing. Another apparent lie would be the claim that they did not shoot down Flight 93. We haven't talked about that, but the significance there is that whereas the question about the first three airplanes was why they were not intercepted and then, if they hadn't followed rules, shot down, it seems that Flight 93 is the one flight that should not have been shot down because it appeared the passengers were wresting control away from the hijackers, and yet it was shot down. And the government claimed that they did not shoot it down.
So what is missing now is an investigation. What kind of investigation can you envision that actually has subpoena power and resources to get to the bottom of it and get beyond the work of the official 9/11 Commission?
Yes, well, it would either have to be a very serious investigation, say by the Senate, of the sort that was done in relation to Watergate and Iran-Contra. Or maybe it would have to be two stages. I suspect it would, that would have to be done enough to establish a prima facie case and then to appoint a special prosecutor. One question people ask is, if there were so many people involved in this, why haven't they come forward? Well, there are many answers to that. One is intimidation, threats. Another is there has been no environment created in this country for coming forward. In fact, just the opposite. Anybody who says this in public, any hint of this, is immediately pilloried and discredited. But if you had a special prosecutor who was not only encouraging people to come forward, but also saying, if you were one of the lowerlings involved here and you fear that you may have some guilt, we will give you immunity for your testimony. I think something like that is probably the only way we will get to this. But a first step will have to be the American press will finally have to quit hiding this issue. Now, my book has come out, in fact, just this week officially in England, and already it has received considerable press coverage in that country. There has been a three-page story in the Daily Mail. I have been on one of the popular afternoon talk shows. I've been on radio over there as well, and I've participated in a documentary that is being made by British TV about this issue. And so already the English public know far more about this than the American public, even though my book came out in the United States in March. We have sent it to 200 to 300 journalists and editors and publishers, and yet not a one of them in the mainstream press has seemed fit even to mention the existence of the book, let alone give it a full review. And so until the press is willing to face up to this issue and the implications it has for the survival of democracy in this country, I'm afraid the Congress will not have the courage to go forward.
You heard part two of a two-part interview with David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. Professor Griffin has taught philosophy of religion at the Claremont School of Theology in Southern California for over 30 years. You can find more information on David Ray Griffin on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of this program with David Ray Griffin by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.